Part 10 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a teaching on compassion with Jack Kornfield.
Compassion is a state natural to us, related to the sorrows of life. Anyone not experienced the sorrows of life? Please let me know. It's a state that arises in the heart, in our awakening. In the face of the sorrows or the pain of another being or of our own. It's said to be the quivering of the heart when it's touched by the pain of beings. The pain of hunger, the pain of loss, pain of fear that all human beings have. It's the healing balm, the movement of the heart in sympathy in relation to that. And often it's taught that each of these four divine qualities in us have a near enemy that masquerades as that true quality, but is really one of separation. So the near enemy of loving kindness is attachment. You may have noticed how love can turn into grasping, haven't you? Right? It feels like love, but it's not exactly the same. It gets possessive and jealous and all that. The near enemy to compassion is pity. Oh, those poor people there who are suffering, as if they were somehow different than us. Whereas true compassion is the openness of the heart to feel the pains and sorrows of another as our own. So what does it mean to be truly helpful? So many of us wrestle with this in this world as, quote, good people, people who have some intention for goodness. And we're appalled by the ecological destruction and the deforestation, or by the homelessness that we see around, or hunger worldwide or in our own communities, by the racism that is a core wound in our society, by Bosnia, and unfortunately Afghanistan, which continues but isn't in the news, and Angola, which continues but isn't in the news, and Somalia, which continues but isn't in the news, and Burma, which continues but isn't in the news, by nuclear proliferation, the sale of underground of nuclear weapons, by our own medical system, which doesn't serve the weakest and poorest members of our society, or which has those who die often off alone, hooked up to machines in some way, or those who are being born, sometimes, again, and necessary, maybe, hooked up to things, especially if you're kind of early, premature, but where there's a certain humanity that's gone. We know about all these things and can be appalled or concerned. They are all given rise to from the forces of greed and hatred and ignorance and delusion. And if we look even for a moment, we can sense our own participation in them. Every time we take our car with one person in it on the highways, kind of oil we use, the participation we have, every one of us here, in a consumer society at the expense often of others. When we sit quietly, even when we go on a picnic or holiday shopping, there's also often a sense of complicity that goes with us, that yes, we have certain privilege, certain ease, but what about all the others who don't have that? It's here with us. So in facing that, what do we seek? a world with no suffering, no loss, no fear, a world with no aging and sickness and no death. Is that possible? Perhaps a reduction of greed, hatred, and delusion? Yet in some ways this describes the human realm, doesn't it? This is human life. And I get phone calls in a way, in a role as a, I don't know, as a spiritual teacher. People will call with difficulties, parents, when they got the call that their child is sick with cancer or something difficult, or parents whose children have committed suicide. Terrible, terrible thing to go through. Or children whose parents, they don't know what to do, put them in a home or bring them into their own home, parents with Alzheimer's, and aging parents with difficulties, people whose lovers are dying. So what do we seek? Really, justice? Yes, we can work for that. But in all this, what is the root of our task? Might it be to seek to love in the midst of all of that? Because there's so many different answers and things we can do, but what underlies that? The movement of the heart, what's called the great heart of compassion, or the Buddha's heart within each being, comes when we remember this capacity, when we're open to that connection, to hold with some mercy or caring, to treasure the life around us. Now, we do forget it, you know. Kierkegaard. Most people really believe that the Christian commandments, such as to love one's neighbor as oneself, are intentionally a little too severe, like putting the clock ahead half an hour to make sure of not being late in the morning, right? That it's kind of a good idea, but they don't really mean it that much. The healing of the sorrows of the world comes first, not by blame, and not by judgment, and also not by denial, by a willingness to see what is, as it is, directly, to let that in. Like the story of Joanna Macy I've told, going and working in the town nearest the Chernobyl nuclear reactor. When will you be able to go outside with your children into the forests and woods again? She asked the mayor and all the people from the town she met with. Not in our great-grandchildren's lifetime, and not in their great-grandchildren's lifetime. It's so poisoned. And kind of pulling their hair out and weeping, why should we even talk about this? It's so painful. Well, at least we can tell our children that we spoke the truth. And perhaps it is our task to bear witness to this so that you, Joanna, and others can go out and tell the world, we must not let this happen to children. We must not let this happen to our forests, to our grandchildren, anywhere. You can't do this. So it's not denial. It is seeing. Willingly, compassion, with passion, a willingness to suffer with. But we're afraid often that our hearts can't do it, that they're not big enough. Remember the account of the woman working in Ram Dass's class of service who passed the homeless person every morning for months on the street person, left some money in his cup, sort of developed this relationship with him in a bit of a way. But then she realized one day that she'd never really looked at him, never really looked him in the eye, to her horror. And when she reflected about it deeply, she realized why. She said, if I ever really looked him in the eye, he would probably be living in my living room within a week. Do you understand that? So does that kind of movement to allow ourselves to look at this human life as it is. And when we do look, how can we not feel when we really let our eyes open, our heart opens? Because we're so connected. We know when somebody's died halfway around the earth sometimes. We feel it in our body. That day we know it. Compassion arises in contact with one another. Somehow we remember in those moments when we're awake who we are. In India, people go to gurus and masters and so forth for a contact that reminds them of this. It's sometimes called the glance of mercy, that you go to be with some great sage, some wonderful enlightened woman or man, and they look at you and there's that moment of just looking in their eyes and your heart melts and all the things that you hated about yourself and struggled with and thought and tried and fixed and so forth just melt away. And it's just a moment of somebody holding you with unconditioned kindness and tenderness in that moment. And it can change somebody's life, that moment. When the heart opens and is unprotected, when it rests in a place of truth. Now, this practice of presence or mindfulness that we do here is the way, one of the ways in Buddhist psychology for opening the heart, for fulfilling this task to find freedom and wisdom. And there's a story that illustrates this practice, especially if you go on a retreat for a week or 2 weeks and so forth. You sit for 6 or 8 hours a day and walk for 6 hours a day. And there's this rhythm that comes of just paying deeper and deeper attention, letting things open as you do. Once upon a time, the story goes, a long time ago, but not so long ago, there was a princess, and she was betrothed to a serpent. It didn't actually fulfill her idea of what marriage should be. And I know serpents have gotten pretty bad rap since sometime in the Bible or whenever. But nevertheless, this was a serpent, and a not particularly nice-looking serpent. So she didn't know what to do, but there she was. You know, this is what happened in her family. She was betrothed to this serpent. So she went and sought out a wise witch. What should I do? And the witch said, marry him. Really? She said. But. And the witch said, I will tell you something to help you, but you must follow my instructions exactly. After the wedding, when you must dress as beautifully as you can in a bridal gown, after the wedding, when you retire to your bedchamber with your newly wed husband, you must wear 10 beautiful dressing gowns, one on top of another. And when you come into the bridal chamber that night, when your husband wishes for you to undress, you must say, yes, I will. But for each layer of clothing that you take off, he too must take off one layer. And then when you've taken off all 10 layers, then you must embrace and kiss him. So they went through the wedding and all of that stuff, and came the night, and there she was with the serpent, the slimy serpent. And she took off one gown, and the serpent, poor serpent, had to take off a layer of skin, as serpents do. One layer, that's all right. And she took off another gown. He was interested, but God, another layer. And it went on that way, 3, 4, 5 to 10 layers. And he took off each layer, getting more and more raw and exposed. And finally he took off the 10th layer and slimy serpent. Ah, she said, well, do I trust the wise witch? Here I am, I've gone this far. She kind of went up to him and embraced him and held him to her and kissed him quite fully. And he turned into, guess what? A slimy serpent, no. A slimy prince, right? Not a good time for princes, I'm sorry. In some ways, that's a description of spiritual life, of those layers of opening. Now, in the founding of transpersonal psychology in the West, Abraham Maslow talked about this, what he called a hierarchy of needs. He had this kind of pyramid, levels of needs. If you got your physical needs met for food and shelter, then you would have social needs to be part of a family and community, and then you would have needs of creativity to be met. And finally, at the peak were spiritual needs, if everything else was covered, you know. And I think this is wrong. Sorry, Abe. Even if your needs are not met, and even if you're hungry and aching, there is still a longing for mercy and a deep wish for connection and compassion and a natural movement of the heart when a child cries and falls and hurts themselves, no matter what your life circumstances. I remember being in Calcutta doing interviews with Scoop Nisker for National Public Radio about spirituality and social responsibility. And after interviewing the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa and so forth, we were interviewing rickshaw wallahs in Calcutta. Calcutta is the place in India that doesn't even have bicycle rickshaws. They have man-pulled rickshaws, those two poles you pick up and carry and run barefoot through the cobblestone streets. It's a very, very hard way to live. And we interviewed this old rickshaw wallah who spoke English pretty well. He was like 60 years old. And he said he had to work every day, that he had saved just a few coins, but that there were 10 people who counted on his income. Mm-hmm. Children, grandchildren, a couple of cousins. And that last year he'd been sick for 2 weeks, and after 10 days they'd run out of money for food. And he talked about how concerned he was for the people that he took care of, that counted on him. It's from Annie Frank. I keep my ideals because in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply cannot build up my hopes on a foundation of confusion, misery, and death. I can feel the sufferings of millions, and yet if I look up into the heavens, I think that it will come right, that this cruelty, too, will sometime end, and that peace and tranquility will, in its season, return to the earth. Ram Dass talked about it at one point, way back in the kind of middle of the Vietnam War demonstrations and things like that, when he was saying that the power of just one clear person who isn't vulnerable, who isn't afraid, is remarkable, transformative to the world. Don't ever underestimate the power of the human heart. When I look deeply at the heart and what's true through that doorway, I see an institution that makes the Pentagon look like children's toys. overcome any bitterness, say the Sufis, that may have come to you because you were not up to the magnitude of the pain that was entrusted to you. We each have a certain measure of cosmic pain. And like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, we are each sharing in the totality of that cosmic pain and are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. It is part of our lot. Compassion opens as awareness deepens. And as this mystery of our identity shifts from the small self, the small story, to some greatness that is our birthright, it shifts gradually as you sit and breathe and pay attention. My body, my family, my friends and loved ones, my community, my part of the earth, my environment, my country, my planet, all of life. It is us. As you open, it's all us. And we gradually extend the sensibility of our attention till a blade of grass becomes mysterious and precious. So the monks in Thailand who try to save the rainforest by going out and putting their robes around the big trees in the old growth, thickest part of the jungles, and ordaining them and calling the abbots of the forest. Because we can't separate ourselves from others. Even their difficulties and pains are ours. Eric Fromm wrote, "We have all been awakened with the Buddha and crucified with Jesus, killed and robbed with Genghis Khan and Stalin and Hitler. We have all been there." That's why the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is such a sacred place. Again, I read some from this notes that were left there. After you all died, I guess two boyfriends, several friends gone was a bit too much for me, and I pretty much screwed up for 10 years. Two boyfriends is just too much, too much. Now I'm better, more responsible. I learned that the pain and loss never goes away. It just changes somehow. And now I work with others to help the vets who've come back. Sometimes I think it's more painful now when I'm not numbed out on chemicals. And I'm still angry. I've had 20 years now to reflect on this madness. And it's still the same. To face the demons. To tell the truth. And like the Buddha on the night of his enlightenment, after discovering this great freedom in the midst of all things, looking out and tears running down his cheeks, that turned into Tara, the goddess of mercy, Bodhisattva of infinite compassion. Seeing beings everywhere who want happiness. If you went up to any of them and caused them pain, they'd say, "No, no, please, I want happiness." Yet doing often the things that bring unhappiness to them and others, that caused him to weep. We want happiness. And he felt their suffering as his own. So you begin with the Bodhisattva vow in many traditions. Beings are numberless. I vow to awaken them all. That's why in those traditional cultures, in part, in the Buddhist cultures, everybody has an honorific that's a relative. Grandfather president, and uncle general, and auntie mayor. And everybody is a relative because they are. Uncle Newt. Right? And great-grandfather Ronald Reagan. That's right. And in a moment when we recognize that, there is a kind of grace. It comes in all kinds of ways. It's evoked, it's touched. There'll just be a moment when you look around and you see human beings and you just go, ah, yes. Sometimes through ritual or reading or nature walks or ceremonies or the sorrows of people around us. But also, it can be cultivated. It can be awakened in us in a systematic way as part of this psychology we speak of. Once on the great Sabbath before Passover, a Hasidic rabbi came home from the house of prayer with weary steps. "What makes you so tired?" asked his wife. "It was the sermon," he replied. "I had to speak of the poor and their many needs for the coming holidays. Bread and wine, everything they needed, has become so expensive this year. They have so little." "And what did you accomplish with your sermon?" his wife asked, as wives do. "Half of what is needed," he said. "You see, the poor are now ready to take. As for the other half, whether those who have are ready to give, I don't know about that yet." It can be cultivated, just as generosity can become a practice that we do. There's a traditional practice of compassion. We did loving kindness meditation last week. Beginning with oneself or someone we love, visualizing them and holding in our heart the sorrows of their life or our life, and wishing well. May you be free of pain and sorrow. May you be peaceful. May you be well. May you be free of sorrow. Oneself, a loved one, a benefactor. In awakening this possibility in this practice, one traditionally begins with the easiest way to open the heart, and then you gradually extend it. Sometimes you start with children, the Buddha's image of a mother caring for her most beloved single child, only child. Because in children there is an innocence and a naturalness, a birthright of love. We all see it. And each child really has the value of all of life. Pablo Casal talked about the miracle of the fingers of a child, that they could play music or create sculpture like Michelangelo or Beethoven, or, you know, that they could lead people into freedom. All the possibilities. Every single child has those possibilities. And you know, if you talk to children who've gone through terrible times in their life and somehow come through it, almost always they'll say that there was somebody in their life. My grandmother, who I get to see once in a while, or an old uncle, or even this neighbor, somebody who saw me, who knew who I was, who loved me, even for a moment, so that I knew inside that I was lovable and worthwhile, even in the midst of a lot of abuse and difficult things. It doesn't take a lot. Just one person, sometimes one moment. And as we naturally sense this in children, for children, then we begin to see that that mercy could extend to anyone who ever was a child. Then you get people like Kala Rinpoche going around and bringing his compassion to the animals in the zoo and the fishes in the tanks, you know. Tell you a story. A devotee, after years of practice, knelt before the master to be initiated as a disciple, finally. And the master whispered the last sacred mantra in his ear, warning him not to reveal it to anyone. But what will happen if I do ask this student? Said the master, anyone you reveal this sacred mantra to will be liberated from the bondage of ignorance and suffering. But if you betray the secret, you yourself will be excluded from being a disciple and instead suffer damnation. No sooner had he heard those words than the disciple rushed to the marketplace, collected as large a crowd as he could around him, and repeated the sacred mantra for all to hear. The disciples reported this back, the other ones, to the teacher, demanded that he be expelled from the monastery, for his disobedience. And the master smiled and said, he has no need of anything in the monastery or that I could offer any more. His actions have shown him to be a true teacher in his own right. Just that natural response to give, to hold. One of the most meaningful things Krishnamurti ever said when I went to go to listen to his talks wasn't all his stuff about, freedom from the known and no authority and stuff like that. He just talked about traveling in a road one day in a car in India, and there was this big rock in the middle of the road that these cars were dodging around, and he had the driver pull over, and he got out and he picked up the rock and he moved it to the side of the road. What matters is not days, but moments. So there's the Dalai Lama, describing the difficulties, the people in Tibet, and then calling the Chinese army, my friends, the enemy, people who taught me compassion. Amazing thing to say. They're the ones, he said, that have really taught me my practice. If my practice means anything at all, that's because of them. And then someone said, but they've taken everything. They have torn down the temples, destroyed the religion, raped women, stopped the use of Tibetan language in places, taken away so much of the culture. How can you still feel compassion for them, love them? And he said, so much has been taken away. I cannot let them take my mind too, my peace. Can I let anyone take that? Every being longs for mercy and respect. And as we sense this and practice it, we sense that there's a natural altruism like water, just as we breathe, when we're present, that wants to touch another. Sometimes it comes through cultivation. Sometimes it comes like that Chinese man in the picture with his shopping bags in front of the tank. Remember, coming back from the market and just standing in the middle of the road saying, you can't do this. You cannot do it. It just comes spontaneously. One day, two policemen were driving up the Pali, which is in Hawaii. This is a story that Joseph Campbell tells. The road, when they saw just beyond the railing that keeps the cars from rolling over, a young man preparing to jump. The police car stopped. The policeman on the right jumped out to grab the man and caught him just as he jumped. And he himself was being pulled over this 1,000-foot cliff when the second officer arrived in time to pull the two of them back. Do you realize what had suddenly happened to that policeman who had given himself to death with that unknown youth? Everything in his life had dropped off. His duty to his family, his duty to his job, his duty to his own life, all of his wishes and hopes and plans for his lifetime had just disappeared. He was about to die. Later, a reporter asked him, why didn't you let go? You could have been killed. And his answer was, I couldn't let go. If I had let that young man go, I couldn't have lived another day of my life. It comes in all kinds of ways. And there's no right way. How you drive and how you garden and how you spend your money and how you save it how you speak to those near to you, how you vote. The yogis in the caves in India contribute to it, spending a life just breathing in and out compassion for the world. And the people in our community and all around us. I have a poem I want to read as a way to close. And then perhaps you might work with this practice of looking honestly at this human life and holding beings with compassion. When the song of the angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flocks, then the true work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner and rebuild the nations, to bring peace among brothers and sisters, to find freedom in the world and to make music in the heart.
This concludes part 10 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. Our program continues with part 11.